Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. It's On the Record. That's the opening of a piece called Rise, a collaboration by composer Judah Adachi and poet Tamika Cage Conley. Adachi's website describes the subject of Rise as, quote, America's fraught civil rights journey from Selma to Ferguson and beyond, end quote. The 40-minute piece for double choir and chamber ensemble premiered last year in Washington, as it turned out, on the same day Freddie Gray died in Baltimore. We're talking this morning about social justice and the role of the artist, composer Judah Adachi, who is on the faculty of the Peabody Institute, frequently takes on social issues in his work. Adachi is teaching a new workshop at the Peabody on art and activism, and he's here with me in the studio. Judah Adachi, welcome to On the Record.
Thank you so much for having me, Sheila.
So what led you to take on the subject of America's civil rights journey?
Well, so this is something that I've had an abiding interest in since, I would say, high school, when I finally got to the point in my life as an artist where my artistic interests and abilities were able to intersect with things that I was passionate about. And I had a commission for a piece that was large scale, 40 minutes. I felt that this was something I could really delve into in a meaningful way.
And you worked with a poet.
Correct. Dr. Tamika Cage Conley. She's an African-American poet. And I had initially set out to do that piece, Rise, using existing poetry. There's so much beautiful work documenting the civil rights movement from the 50s and the 60s. But I think, as we're vividly and painfully aware at this moment, this is an ongoing movement. This is not a movement that ended. We're very much in this today, and I wanted a young poet and a young African-American voice to kind of speak to this with me so that we could explore this journey that took us, as I said, from Selma to the present day together.
What do you think music can do in terms of social justice that a documentary or a book doesn't do?
So I really think of making art in general as an act of empathy. No matter what you're doing, it doesn't have to be concerned with social justice. I think when you're writing a piece of music, you know, most of the time you're inspired by something. In my case, it's often literature. I often read a poem or a book, or I may encounter a situation or a person that moves me in some way, someone I admire, someone I want to pay homage to, something I want to bear witness to in some way. And I think music allows you to do that, first of all, in an abstract way, whether there are words or it's purely instrumental. I think music lets you do that at many levels. You don't have to be explicit about it. I think you can do it in a way that carries different degrees of subtlety that may not be possible in journalism and documentary. And then the other aspect of this that's important to me is music takes place in time. And obviously a documentary does as well. But I think you have a lot of say as a composer in how you create an experience around something. So if you're telling a story around the civil rights movement, if you're telling a story, I'm doing in my next piece, about Kalief Browder, this young man who'd killed himself not long after being in solitary confinement at Rikers Island, you have the opportunity to create a space where the audience has to sit with it for a certain amount of time. They have to sit with the narrative. They have to sit with the discomfort of the story. They have to kind of abide with this person and with this idea and with this pain. I think that's something that music brings that is singular.
Let me pick up on the piece that you're working on about Kalief Browder. You told us a little bit. Mm-hmm. Tell us more about what grabbed you about his story.
Absolutely. So Kalief Browder's story is not singular, unfortunately. It is a powerful example, I think. Kalief Browder, just to share his story for people who don't know it, was a young man who at age 16 in 2010 was arrested in the Bronx, accused of stealing a backpack. He was taken to Rikers Island, where he was held for 3 years, two of them spent in solitary confinement. And at no point was he convicted of a crime, but he spent this time there nonetheless. His trial was repeatedly delayed and delayed and delayed, and ultimately the charges were dropped. You know, over 1,000 days on Rikers Island, he was released, and then roughly a year and some change after he was released, he committed suicide, presumably because of the effects of that experience on his life. You know, I read an article, a stunning article by Jennifer Gonerman in The New Yorker that really told Kalief Browder's story. She interviewed him just as he was released, and sadly, he committed suicide in 2015. When I read this story, I think what interests me most, I would say, are the immediate human dimensions of these sociopolitical issues, when you can really look at a person, especially a young person, that embodies something systemic. This stayed with me, and when I had an opportunity to apply for a grant, that was the story that I wanted to tell.
So tell me what your creative process is, then, to try to make art of that.
It's difficult. I'm far removed from Kalief Browder in so many ways, in age, in race, in life experience, in privilege, in any number of ways. You know, I've done a lot of reading about the case. That's been one thing that I've been able to do. But I've looked for small but meaningful and human points of entry into his story. So one thing I did was I went up to New York City and spent the day kind of walking in his footsteps. Not all the way to Rikers Island. That's a difficult part to achieve. But the first part of his story, where sort of the beginning of this long descent that led to his suicide, I went to Arthur Avenue in the Bronx and spent quite some time at the intersection where he was arrested, just trying to imagine just walking through this beautiful neighborhood. But that day was the beginning of the end for Kalief Browder. So I spent time there, and I sort of tracked his path following Jennifer Gonerman's article. Went to the precinct where he was brought, then he went to the courthouse. And, you know, he was on this inexorable path that he did not know at that point would lead to Rikers Island, and specifically to all this time, not only on Rikers, but in solitary. I can't presume to enter into his mind, but I tried to walk in his footsteps a little bit, literally. Jennifer's article also talks about little things about him, the books he read in prison. I'm reading those. You know, I'm just trying to do what I can to draw a little closer to this person, and I feel that if I can arrive at that point of empathy, that gives me an avenue to open it up to others so that we can all sit with this and think about how we are maybe complicit in it.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with composer Judah Adashi about social justice and the role of the artist. What pitfalls do you see in making music that is overtly political?
Oh, there's so many. You know, it's a risk, and I think you have to make decisions about what are you prioritizing? Are you an artist first? Are you an activist? What are you doing? And
Do you have an answer to that?
An artist first, absolutely. I think that just as in any artistic venture, there's a lot of not very good art that's been made around sociopolitical issues, and sometimes when you try too hard to make a point, I think that can become very heavy-handed. I think that can become very preachy. I said earlier that I think one of the things that music can do is exercise varying degrees of subtlety and restraint. I hope, you know, what these works are maybe able to do is create a space for communion where people can sit together and let this story in and see what it does to them. One of the things we're reading in this art and activism workshop I'm teaching is an article by a composer friend of mine named David T. Little. He makes a distinction between two kinds of art about politics or engaging in socio-political issues. He says there's revolutionary art, which is ideological and tries to change minds. And then he says there's critical art, which is more open-ended. It looks at things much as a documentary would. It looks at things from multiple perspectives. It may have an ideological slant. Obviously, I have strong opinions about Kalief Browder's story. But the point is less to say you should think this and more let me tell this story so that we don't erase it in our historical memory. Let me, as he puts it, an act of counter-memory, you know, making sure that we fight amnesia, that we don't let the Kalief Browders of the world just become hashtags, just become, you know, a rallying cry, that this is a human being. This is a young boy who didn't get to see his life into his 20s because he was accused of stealing a backpack and nothing more. And that, I think, that isn't politics. I think that's deeply human and something I hope I can make something of through music.
Before I let you go, tell me about this art and activism workshop.
All of this project has been made possible by a grant from the Berman Institute of Bioethics. They spearheaded this initiative called the Practical Ethics Initiative, which sort of casts a wider net of questions to people in nursing, in business, in public health, in music. How do we deal with ethical issues in our field? And so to me, that was a twofold question. I know a little bit of the answer for myself, which is I do like to engage with these issues in my music. So part of the grant application was this piece about Kalief Browder. The other part was this workshop that I wanted to run with my students at Peabody. And I have a cohort of about 10 students who are selected, and we're spending the fall semester in a kind of seminar asking some of the questions you're asking me, in a way. What can music do, especially classical music, that is often on the fringes of these conversations? What can we do to engage with these issues that we're passionate about in the world meaningfully? Each of these students has their own project that they'd like to get off the ground. And so in the fall, we're focusing on more of a seminar where we can all discuss these issues broadly. And then we're going to zoom in to kind of a practicum in the spring and see what we can do to help them launch their own efforts to intertwine their musical gifts and their musical training and musical work with social justice-oriented projects.
You use the word responsibility in describing this workshop, this art and activism workshop, which raises for me the question, is a musician who does not address social causes abdicating responsibility?
I think the answer is no. I think the answer is different for everybody. I mean, there are many artists I admire who keep these things very separate. People will cite one of my heroes, Nina Simone, saying that she believes it's an artist's duty to reflect the times. How can you be an artist and not reflect the times? I think for me that rings true, but I don't wish to impose that on my students. I want them to go on this journey of figuring out how they can engage meaningfully. What is the point where their art and their concerns about how life in their city and life in their world is working, where do those things touch? And how do those things touch in a way that they can make a meaningful difference? Again, I don't think there's one path for everybody on this, but I hope that through this exploration, they can find their path.
Thank you for discussing it with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Judah Adashi is a composer on the faculty of the Peabody Institute of the Johns Hopkins University. He's also founder and artistic director of the Evolution Contemporary Music Series. At the On the Record page at WYPR.org, there's a link to listen to the full invocation from his composition, Rise. This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Quick break now. When we come back, we'll hear about another Hopkins arts endeavor, a fund to support budding audiovisual artists. Stay with us.